evening. Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. We welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY, here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But hold your calls. We have this evening Barrett Schoss, one of my favorite guests. We're going to be talking about the Supreme Court. We're going to be talking about the Ten Commandments Monument in Montgomery. We're going to be talking about the conspiracy against God. As we pointed out to you before, every session of the Supreme Court begins when the crier comes in and pronounces, "God save the United States and this honorable court." God save the United States and this honorable court. That's how the Supreme Court opens its sessions. Certainly above where the Supreme Court Chief Justice sits, is on a relief engraved in marble above his head, is a replica of the Ten Commandments. The Congress opens with prayer. The Senate opens with prayer. So why is it that the Supreme Court justices, a majority of them, say that we have to take God out of public institutions? Well, because they want to destroy the Christian foundation of this country. I mean, this is what they've been doing. They've been working at this since the mid-1960s, just a little here, a little there. And, of course, just if you don't take too much away at a time, why people don't understand that their religious freedom is under attack. And most people would rather switch than fight. Well, there comes a time when people have to take a stand, and I think we are deeply indebted to Judge Roy Moore for being willing to take that stand on all the flack as he's attacked by the Wall Street Journal, and everybody knows it's conservative, well, that's because we're told it's conservative, but in reality, of course, it's run by the same people that run the New York Times and the Washington Post, who also have been attacking Judge Roy Moore. And David Limbaugh, Rush Limbaugh's brother, has condemned him for this. After all, we are a nation of law. But what happens if we have a lawless court? Well, we're going to be talking about all these things and much more tonight with Barrett Schoss. Barrett, thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thank you, Dr. Stan. It's so good to be back with you.
Well, tell us your take on what's going on and how do we understand this? How do we convince people that this is not an accident, this is not a quirk, this is not a passing fad? There is a conspiracy against God. There is a conspiracy to destroy the Christian or Judeo-Christian foundation of this once great nation.
Oh, you know, it's been going on for a long time, hasn't it, Dr. Stan?
It sure has.
You know, you can go back to before the founding of the United Nations back in the 30s and 40s and the beginnings of the Council of Churches when Alger Hiss was a leader in that movement to establish a National Council of Churches. It was the Federal Council of Churches first, and he was, of course, the first head of the United Nations when it was established in San Francisco in 1945. A communist was the head of that institution. The first two leaders, of course, two of the early leaders, in addition to Alger Hiss, was Brock Chisholm, who headed up the World Health Organization, and Julian Huxley, who headed up UNESCO. And those two men hated Christianity, and it didn't take long before those ideals were formalized as an agenda 50 years ago, more than 50 years ago, to literally wipe out what Brock Chisholm called the poisonous certainties of Christianity. They didn't fit the global society.
And of course, the global society and the new religion that will replace Christianity sort of go hand in hand, don't they?
Oh, absolutely. and that the new religion is totally incompatible with biblical Christianity because it's based on the idea that somehow we blend everything, we come up with a universal spirit. I mean, it's so much like what Aldous Huxley wrote in Brave New World. Here he called this new God Ford. It's almost laughable, but what his message, and you can laugh at it because some of it seems so ridiculous, but when you look back at what he wrote and these rituals to this universal God that everybody had to participate in, it fits just exactly what I saw when I was in Istanbul for the UN Conference on Human Settlements, and I looked at all the model samples of the communities. They had filled two huge buildings at the piers in Istanbul, huge pier buildings for storing the kind of things that were shipped around the world, but they were taken over, especially one for model housing. These are the best models, the examples for everybody who came from around the world. And every one of them had communities, high rises, condominium type of thing that's sprouting up all over our country. But they always had a community center in the middle because everybody had to get along together and dialogue and share their, have spiritual ceremonies, like the Olympics again, where you blend together earth-centered religions and you ridicule Christianity and you change your minds of people so that they learn to despise Christianity and love this new modern unifying belief system that somehow draws everyone together, as you know, of course, Buddhism and Native American spirituality are good models for this. But the fact that our Supreme Court now is saying, Supreme Court Justices Ginsburg announced recently, that Supreme Court is looking beyond America's borders for guidelines in handling cases on issues like the death penalty and gay rights.
She should be impeached for a violation of her oath to uphold the Constitution.
Right. Justice Breyer goes right along with it. I mean, I'm sure you've talked about this, but can I just quote what he said again?
Go right ahead.
He said, "The world is going together through commerce, through globalization, through the spread of democratic institutions, socialist institutions is what we should say, through immigration to America. It's becoming," see where immigration fits in. "To accomplish a change, you have to mingle people, you have to have a diverse community around the world, and the type of diversity that will, you know, put aside the old basis, because if you're going to have a democracy, you're going to persuade the people, and the votes of the people is going to count, but the people are being manipulated, and they don't even know it."
And of course, it's so interesting, you were talking about these model communities they had in Istanbul. We are going to do this in Iraq. The reason we're there, of course, was not because of wicked Saddam Hussein, because we'd kept the wicked Saddam Hussein in power, and every time the military tried to overthrow him, of course, we intervened and betrayed the military leaders so that we could keep Saddam in power. And if you're out there in the listening audience and you doubt that, I'd suggest the book, See No Evil by Robert Baer, who was a CIA agent actually in Iraq, or my March newsletter gives a quotation. But, you know, they're planning to keep American troops there permanently. Now, they may talk about all sorts of things, bringing the boys home as soon as we've got stability, but they're not going to have stability. We are going to rebuild that society in our own image. And, of course, they got the television dishes on every rooftop there so they can funnel the ideas into television. They're going to remake the school system so that they can indoctrinate the Arab children there in these ideas of communitarianism. And people have to understand, of course, that they will do everything they can to destroy their faith and their religion and replace it with this new universal religion you're talking about.
Right. I won't continue that line, but I could say much about that. I'll finish Justice Breyer's quote, because he goes on to say, "And whether our Constitution fits into the governing documents of other nations, I think, will be a challenge for the next generation." And, of course, it's being challenged right now. They're putting aside, and we've been seeing that for a long time, but it's been just zooming forward in the last couple of years. Especially, and now we're going to be looking at the governing documents of other nations and the United Nations as models for what we're going to do. And of course, what they have to do, it would be a challenge to squeeze the Constitution into those models, and they can't. And so it means that the Constitution has to be bent and squeezed and twisted and changed to fit the new global vision. And nothing is going to change or undermine everything we've known in this country of freedom and human rights faster than molding our Constitution to fit what's going on in Europe and its ideology, because they've just turned against God. And can I just cite some illustrations?
You go right ahead.
This is all from our latest article called Ban Truth and Keep Reap Tyranny. And I have all the links. I'm going to just quickly run through some of those illustrations, and the links are all in that article on our website. For example, France passed an anti-cult law. Now courts can dissolve religious groups and impose heavy fines if people don't fit into the new system. Churches are being watched. Pastors, the link to this part, goes to this a particular article which interviews various pastors who talk about how they are being followed, how they're being monitored and listed as questionable churches because, again, they take a biblical position and it doesn't fit. In fact, they're accused of manipulating or brainwashing. They don't use the word brainwashing, but, for example, they say, if we want to have children's church or Sunday school, that can be seen as influencing minors. In other words, it's very questionable whether you're going to be allowed to teach Christianity to children because you're influencing these children and their malleable minds. And they say, if we work with old people, it's preying on the vulnerable. So again, they're limited as far as sharing the gospel with the various people who need it the most in the society. In Sweden, they passed one vote. They're in the process of passing a law to criminalize opposition to homosexuality so that people from the homosexual lobby group could sit in churches, have a tape recorder on, and listen to somebody, and then accuse them of speaking against the Constitution, the new Constitution, which would be, include the concept that you cannot oppose homosexuality or quote the biblical scriptures that say homosexuality is a sin. And this particular pastor says the real intent is to criminalize Christianity.
Well, you know, I think people have to understand that this is all satanic. This is all Luciferian. This is an effort to corrupt the whole world. And when you understand that, then it all makes sense. If you're looking for logic there, there is no logic. But the tragedy is this is at the highest levels of our government today. And that's why Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Stephen Breyer are on the Supreme Court, because Bill Clinton knew and the people who controlled him knew exactly how they felt. And we have to only understand that Bill and Hillary Clinton are involved in the occult. Bill Clinton was the highest-ranking DMOLE, that's a Masonic organization in the United States. Hillary, well, she used to bring people into the White House to conjure up spirits. What does that suggest to you that we're dealing with? And people must understand that these forces are there in Washington, D.C. I mean, they brought in Jean Houston to conjure up the spirits of Eleanor Roosevelt and Mohandas Gandhi, and everybody thought it was funny. It wasn't funny at all. It should have set a chill down everybody's back to realize the degree of evil that was there.
I totally agree. And what we're seeing, actually, is sort of, we're seeing history repeat itself. This is the cycles of history over and over again, and we see it back in ancient Israel when the people rejected God's truth and began to turn to all these other gods, Moloch and Baal and the other gods that required child sacrifice and in all kinds of rituals. One of the scriptures I wanted to point out, maybe I can do it right here, but we have a lot more information to share, but just to give a background, a biblical foundation for what we're talking about. For example, if we go back to Deuteronomy 28, one of those amazing chapters in the Old Testament that shows exactly what would happen. Let me just read what would happen if we follow God. It says, if you diligently obey the voice of the Lord your God to observe carefully all his commandments which I command you today, The Lord your God will set you high above all the nations of the earth. The Lord will cause your enemies to rise against you to be defeated before your face. The Lord will open to you his good treasure, the heavens, to give rain to your land in its season and to bless the work of your hand. You shall lend to many nations, but you shall not borrow. And the Lord will make you the head and not the tail, if you heed the commandments of your Lord. But then he goes on to say, a little later, I mean, I suggest everyone read the whole chapter because it's just amazing and it's just what's happening. It says, if you do not obey the voice of the Lord your God to observe carefully all his commandments, that then all these curses will come upon you and overtake you. The Lord will strike you with consumption, with fever, with inflammation, with burning fever, with a sword, with scorching, and with mildew. The Lord will change your rain to powder and dust. The Lord will cause you to be defeated before your enemies. A nation you have not known shall eat the fruit of your land and the produce of your labor. Locusts shall consume your trees. The alien who is among you shall rise higher and higher above you, and you shall come down lower and lower. He shall lend to you, but you shall not lend to him. He shall be the head, and you will be the tail, because you did not serve the Lord your God with joy and gladness of heart. And I want to mention that when George Washington gave his final farewell speech, he put his hand on the Bible, and it was placed on, the Bible was opened up to the 28th chapter of Deuteronomy, what I just read. He knew so well how important it was to follow God that there would be no success, no victory, no prosperity, no freedom apart from God. And of course, that's what Judge Moore also knew and why he took his position as he did. And I know many have criticized him. Can I just read one statement from him? You probably read it, but it fits in with what we're talking about.
You go right ahead now, because may have read it, but our listeners don't know what it is. Please go ahead, Barry.
Well, we must acknowledge God in the public sector because the state constitution explicitly requires us to do so. The Alabama Constitution specifically invokes, quote, the favor and guidance of the Almighty God as the basis of our laws and justice system. As the Chief Justice of the State Supreme Court, I am entrusted with the sacred duty to uphold the state constitution. I have taken an oath before God and man to do such, and I will not waver from that commitment. He couldn't do anything else. And in our country, there was a time when we had the freedom to follow our conscience. And we don't anymore. We don't have that freedom. It's just amazing what has eroded, or how much of our freedom has eroded in this country. I can't read this, but remember, you know, what Peter, the disciple and apostle, said when he was told, don't speak about God. And he said, whether it's right in the sight of God to give heed to you rather than to God, you be the judge, for we cannot stop speaking what we have seen and heard. That's in Acts 4:19. And in that, he continues to speak even though he's told not to. And again, in chapter 5 in Acts, he says, we must obey God rather than man. And of course, that's where Judge Moore stood. And I just so appreciate such a model at this time, because most people are just bending over backwards to conform to the twisted understanding of Constitution.
But you know, the real tragedy, Barrett, is that so the media, almost all of it, is on the other side and being critical of him. We're a nation of laws. He's a judge. He doesn't know of the right to defy the law. I mean, after all, are we going to have a revolution? And when people defy the law, they determine what the law is, you know. And of course, the reply would be, what law? I mean, judges don't make law.
No.
They only interpret the law. And this judge made a law going along with a lawless law, which basically said there was a wall of separation between church and state, which there is not. It has never existed. And, of course, they know that. And they opened the Supreme Court, every one of its sessions, with a statement, God save the United States and this honorable court. Maybe we ought to pray God destroy this honorable court, because these are not honorable men. We'll be back here in just a few minutes, and we'll, of course, have to take a break here. And then, of course, we'll return to our listeners up there in the Great Northwest. Dr. Stan, and of course our guest is Barrett Chose. We're talking about the conspiracy against God. That's exactly what it is. And of course, since we attributed our freedom came from God, for we hold these truths to be self-evident that all men are created equal and endowed by the Creator with certain unalienable rights, among which are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And to ensure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their authority from the consent of the governed. Now, how many people honestly believe that the majority of the American people believe that they should take the monuments out? Actually, I think over 77% say this is wrong. Even though all the media is on the other side, the average American has a lot more common sense. Of course, the people who want to take it out are the ones who have been to college for 4 years and indoctrinated with all these crazy ideas. Well, this is a point we have to draw the line in the sand, and this is it. And we have to point out that the Supreme Court has been taken over by people who have an agenda, and as you've heard me say in the past, and you will hear me say many times again, the Supreme Court was taken over by Freemasons. They had an agenda. They worship a different God, whether they know it or not. And they control the Supreme Court from 1941 to 1971 with majorities of 5-4 to 8-1. Go ahead, Barrett.
I it's amazing to see the statistics that show the number of high-level 32nd and 33rd degree Masons in the Supreme Court, in our Congress. It's amazing. It's heartbreaking because all of a sudden everything makes sense and you can see. I know I've quoted before the mayor of New York back in the 30s who said, well, it's really frightening. I'll find that in the next break because it's amazing how he saw a shadow government from behind the scenes back then. And so we certainly are moving toward an end that is anything but the America that we have loved. Back to Judge Moore, I think it's interesting that one of the points he made in his argument against removing the Ten Commandments was the fact that Judge Thompson, who would be working in a federal courthouse, has in front of his building, in front of the federal courthouse, a sculpture of Themis, the Greek goddess of law and justice. That's perfectly permissible in front, as part of the federal courthouse scenery outside. The decoration is part of a beautiful fountain paid for with federal funds, and that's permissible, but the Ten Commandments are not, and it just is an illustration of the choice we face right now. Are we going to go with, put aside the Christian values, or are we going to claim God's sovereignty and providence in this country and acknowledge His name, which is represented by the Ten Commandments, or are we going to choose the values of paganism as symbolized by Themis, this Greek goddess? People are closing their, it's like back in Martin Luther King's days. It was okay when he resisted, his peaceful revolution was applauded by newspapers, and there's a Martin Luther King Day we're supposed to honor what he accomplished. And I know that it was a good thing to
we'll
do.
We'll be right here in just a minute. We've got to just bring our listeners back from the... Well, Dr. Stan, and of course our guest today is Barrett Chose. And her website, of course, is crossroad.to. Crossroad.to. You want to go there and start pulling down some of the wonderful, wonderful information that's on Barrett's website. But of course, the analogy, when Martin Luther King and his followers violated the laws of our country to prove a point why they were applauded by the media. When Judge Roy Moore does the same thing, of course, he's criticized. Why? Because, of course, it takes a Christian position.
Right. It's all a matter of whether you're politically correct or not. Are you following the program? Are you moving into the new ideals for tolerance and diversity and inclusiveness that is so central to the new global spirituality? You have to put aside the exclusive what they call exclusive and intolerant Christianity. Of course, when you put aside all the nice rhetoric, you know that the people who call for tolerance are some of the most intolerant people, whereas those who have called for Christian faithfulness have gone to people around the world, loving every people from every race, every culture around the world, and trying to build hospitals and schools. They have showed love. They have cared. No other religion has done that. I think we need to point out that what we're fighting for is a freedom to really care about people and love them and show them the truth that can save both lands and people, and a different kind of salvation. I'm not saying that, but to bring the kind of peace and freedom that our founders called for when they proclaimed God's providence and honored His name in words, even though some of them were not born again, they still knew the importance of God's word as a foundation both for law and for culture.
All right, fine. Well, of course, there's a great deal that can be done if people want to do it. And there are laws that are being presented, bills being presented both in the House and the Senate to limit what the Supreme Court can do and to pass laws saying they can't say anything at all about God or prayer and they have no right to interfere as far as the worship is concerned. And there are a number of congressmen and a number of senators who put those laws forward, and they're getting the conspiracy of silence out across America. If you want to know more about them, go to eagleforum.com, or eagleforum, I should say, .org, Phyllis Schlafly's website. She's got the material up there. Have you heard about those laws, Barrett?
No, I haven't.
Well, of course, see, the thing is, they isolate us, and because they control the mass media, if people aren't listening to programs like this, they're not going to know that many of the senators and the congressmen share our concern about what's going on. And they're actually trying to get legislation. If we could get enough people writing letters there, why, we could, of course, get the other rest of the congressmen who really would go along with this sort of thing. They even passed a bill up there saying they couldn't use any federal funds to actually remove that Ten Commandments monument. Now, that was a sort of a feel-good situation, but almost all the congressmen, almost all the senators voted for that. Didn't do any good, of course, but you have to understand that if we can build a consensus and we can get enough pressure and enthusiasm behind this legislation, why, it can go through. So I would suggest to people go to Phyllis Schlafly's website. I'll try to get Phyllis on this program sometime soon, and we can cover exactly what we're talking about.
Well, that sounds wonderful. I'm glad to hear there's some positive steps that we can take that could really make a difference.
You see, under the Constitution, Congress can limit what the Supreme Court can do. They can limit what the federal courts can do in the Article 1 and what the Supreme Court can do in Article 3, Section 2. So it's built in, it's constitutional. In fact, I think it was Tom Daschle got a special bill put through a year or so ago saying the Supreme Court couldn't make any decision on the EPA as far as fighting forest fires in his state. Specifically, that legislation, so the Supreme Court couldn't interfere because the EPA was going to try to stop him from stopping the forest fires. And so he got that legislation through. If Tom Daschle can do it, why, we ought to be able to do it to save the Religious Foundation of America.
Right. Right, we've got to work on the schools too, because there's a lot more going on. And in this article, Ban Truth and Reap Tyranny, I mentioned that, you know, the same month or just weeks before the Ten Commandments was removed from the Alabama State Judicial Building, two schools were robbed of their Ten Commandments. It was very interesting. Parents and protesters were flying outside the school as the crane picked up these tablets outside a public school. But that kind of action is taking place all over too.
We'll be right back in just a moment. Thank you. This is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and of course our guest today is Barrett Schoes. If you're out there in the listening audience, would like to give us a call, our number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Maybe you agree, maybe you disagree. Let's hear from you. 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 464-8295. Go ahead, Barrett.
I just want to point out some of the trends, because the same trends that we see in Europe as far as shutting out, and I gave two of five or six examples that I have in this article that I suggest people, our listeners, read. It goes on to show the same thing happening in schools, for example, in some of our listeners may have heard some of these stories, but for example, one school that allowed children to exchange Valentines featuring Britney Spears and other things that are immoral, violated a second grader's constitutional right by rejecting her homemade cards which celebrated Jesus. A kindergartner, in a different story, was assigned to draw a poster showing environmental issues, and he drew people picking up litter and children holding hands and a picture of Jesus in the corner, and the teacher censored it. A second grade class was told to bring books to class that represented their Christmas tradition, and one little girl named Laura was the only student to bring in a religious-based book, and she was told she couldn't share her book with the class. Many of us are probably very familiar with the fact that Rutgers University banned a Christian group that was InterVarsity from using campus facilities and stripped the group InterVarsity of university funding because it selects leaders on the basis of religious belief. In other words, InterVarsity chose leaders and teachers who were Christians, but that was not permissible. And so they were trying to ban the group entirely so that they would not have any group that would not allow homosexuals to lead, as well as it wouldn't have that kind of diversity in its leadership. Young Life faced the same kind of challenge. We just see across the country, we're seeing leaders in charge. And again, Dr. Stan, it's people who have for many, many years planned. It gets back to conspiracy. And you know, when you look at, for example, the ACLU, and I mentioned that the Ten Commandments were removed from two public schools in Alabama that same, right before the issue at with Judge Moore, that was because of a suit by American Civil Liberties Union, the ACLU, which of course has supported any group of activity that would undermine Christian values from its beginning, which isn't very surprising when you know that its founder, Roger Baldwin, was a committed communist.
Well, I would like to call them the Anti-Christian Lawyers Union, the ACLU.
Yes, that's a good name for it. But they're not the, you know, there have been so many groups which, like ACLU, have tried to undermine and infiltrate other groups, and in order to change the leadership and implement their vision and their values.
But they know if they can, of course, destroy the Christian foundation of this nation, they can institute a dictatorship for, as William Penn had said so well, those who will not be ruled by God will be ruled by tyrants. And if people have no moral foundation to curb their passions, why, you're going to have an all-powerful government to regulate them. And, of course, once we renounce God, we renounce the foundations of the Declaration of Independence, which was the foundation of our Constitution, which is the foundation of our freedom. And these people know exactly what they're doing. They've been at it for generations, because this is an intergenerational movement. As Masonry and all of the secret societies date really back to the time when the Rosicrucians came to America in about 1640. And their goal was to take over this country and to use it one day to lead the world into a new world order and a new world religion. That was the dream of reconstituting lost Atlantis. And it was based upon a book that had been written by Francis Bacon called The New Atlantis, and they dreamed that one day America would lead the world. And today America leads the world. And where are we leading them? Why, into a new international or a new world order? And if you don't believe that's the goal, you go to the Project for the New American century website and read their letters, their statement of principles, where they talk about our purpose is for America to lead a new international order.
You know, I found that quote, and it fits right in. This New York Mayor John Hyland, back in 1922, and he said, "The real menace of our republic is this invisible government, which, like a giant octopus, sprawls its slimy length over city, state, and nation. Like the octopus of real life, it operates under cover of a self-created screen. It seizes in its long and powerful tentacles our executive offices, our legislative bodies, our schools, our courts, our newspapers, and every agency created for the public protection." And what, of course, they've done is, instead of protecting the public, they're protecting, they're shielding that part of the public that holds on to traditional values from any kind of influence, and teaching our children to...
Well, that's why anybody who loves their children should get them out of the school. If you have children or grandchildren in a government school, get them out. And you really want to get a copy of Barrett Chose's excellent book, Brave New Schools. It's must reading, and it's available at Radio Liberty. Brave New Schools, to find out what they're really doing to our children.
May I just... Can I just read a statement for those who are not familiar? Have you talked? Can I?
You go right ahead.
Okay. You know, I never quite know what you have covered thoroughly before, but I think it's amazing to just consider that the executive director and the, you know, moving spirit until 1950 was Roger Baldwin, the founder, and he said, "I seek the social ownership of property, the abolition of the property class, and sole control by those who produce wealth. Communism is, of course, the goal." And then he told the people, he gave this advice, quote, "Do steer away from making it look like a socialist enterprise. We want also to look like patriots in everything we do." It's a nice cover for them.
Well, of course it is. But you see, what it's really all about, when they talk about socialism, they're really not talking about dividing everything up equally. They're talking about a ruling elite, and they're controlling everybody else, and then the ruling elite provides for them whatever they want to provide that's left over after their high living and excesses.
Right, right. I mean, I've been thinking about doing a chart, Dr. Stan, showing slavery as it was before it was ended. I mean, around the world there was slavery, and it was ended by the United States and Great Britain. It's interesting, you know, the two countries that are accused of having slaves. Yes, they did, but it was a global institution. Slavery was ubiquitous around the world. And what's happening now is very close to slavery. I mean, where we're heading, I heard a missionary from Japan speak yesterday, and he was talking about starting new churches and working with youth groups and so on in Japan. They've been very successful. It's a very hard place to have a mission field. But he said one of the hard things there is that Japanese companies move their people anytime they choose. The people cannot even choose not to participate. If they want to move, he said, across the country in Japan, where they have started small churches, one of the biggest problems is that somebody, a leader in the church, a deacon, all of a sudden is taken from where he lives and maybe moved to the northern part or the eastern part or somewhere totally away. He has no choice. The whole family has to go when their business tells them to move. And I see us heading with the huge transnational corporations and with the unemployment rising, there's going to be less and less choice and more control over the lives of people. They get their benefits, but so did the people who were slaves of a family. And when it was a benevolent family, they actually lived with that family and had it very nice. When it was a cruel family who didn't care, it was horrible. But we're going to be looking at people under control in this global society.
That's what the Office of Homeland Security is really all about. I mean, if anybody really thinks we're fighting terrorism, why is the southern border open? Why is it that they've only allowed 150 pilots to be armed so far? You say they're turning out 50 a week. Yeah, but how many weeks have they been doing that? And, of course, they certainly only recently have they increased the number of air marshals now. I mean, 2 years since 9/11, they're going to add another 5,000 air marshals. Why did it take this long to do that? Are we really fighting terrorism? Or is this simply, is this simply to confuse the American people? I mean, we know where all these terrorists were. We knew where every terrorist was in the United States on September 11th. That's how we could arrest 1,200 people within the next day or two, and many of those are still in detention. Have you ever wondered why we haven't had any other terrorist attacks in the United States since September 11th, except for the anthrax attack? Why no other attacks? Because we picked up all the terrorists that were here, and we're tracking the terrorists throughout the world very carefully. The people in charge aren't going to let these foolish terrorists, deter them from their real goal, the New World Order, the New World Religion. But we had to have a new enemy. And now, of course, we justify being at war in Iraq because we're fighting terrorism there, even though Iraq has never been listed by the State Department as a terrorist nation.
It's amazing. We discussed the Homeland Security, and in the article that I wrote, I tried to point out that, in all the different ways that we might be considered terrorists, Dr. Stan, it's as if it's a subtle way. Well, you talked about this. I don't need to say it. Let me just mention one example.
You go ahead and say whatever you want to say. Don't be bashful. Because my voice isn't very good anyway.
No, it sounds like you have a problem with your voice tonight. I was talking with one young woman who is a missionary, and she was going to Great Britain for some training. And she's helping others with computer work and so on in the mission field and translating languages. But she was supposed to be going through a learning session, a training in London. She flew in from United States to London. She had her visa, and they wouldn't let her in. And there's no reason why they shouldn't have let her in, but they wouldn't let her in. She had to fly right back again to the United States. I don't know why. I know that UK now is talking about requiring the DNA of every person, every citizen, and using that to check people who come and go from the airport. But they're letting in all kinds of people who bring immense problems into the nation.
Yeah, but I mean, this woman was a Christian. That would be the difference.
That's what I wondered. I don't know, Dr. Stan, but she trusted God and she wasn't upset. But it was just a change of plans, and she was very confused, and nobody could understand really why that was happening.
Well, I can understand why it's happening, because I know a couple of my friends who are Christians who were targeted at the airport. In fact, one of them was a woman named Barrett Chose.
Right, but that was a little bit, with orange tags and lots of, checking of luggage and so on. But this, at least I got into all the places I was going eventually, but with Gratila watching. Anyway, Dr. Stan, it's a challenging time, and it's a time when more than ever we can, just be glad we know the sovereign God of the universe, and that no matter how hard it is, He is with us. And He says, be strong and of good courage. Be not frightened, neither be dismayed, for the Lord your God is with you wherever you go. And I just hold on to that, and I don't mind traveling anywhere. The one other thing I thought we might want to just discuss for a moment is, if we could go back to global spirituality for a moment.
We certainly can.
Because I think it's been very interesting to just see the two groups, the two models right now who are in a way competing for preeminence in the leadership of the global spirituality or the interfaith movement. And two of those are Episcopal Bishop Swing, who I wrote about in an article called Heresy in High Places. He's the Episcopal Bishop, and I thought it was kind of interesting that the fact that a homosexual bishop was elected became a very big event in this country, a very amazing and alarming event, but it received a lot of media, but very little media attention has been given to Episcopal Archbishop Swing, who founded United Religions Initiative. It's very interesting to see how he has promoted outright paganism. And I went to one of the worship services at the Presidio, after the United Religions URI moved to the Presidio, and of course they worshipped all different kinds of God. You chanted Om, Krishna, Om, and then I won't even say it anymore, but they put just about every spiritual leader, so every deity, with Om as they worshipped and praised these different gods.
No, basically the Presidio then is really a center for the occult, isn't it? Because
it's become a global
there. We know that George Lucas is there.
Yes.
And of course the Star Wars fame. Of course that was all based upon the occult. So there are a whole flock of occult organizations. Is there anybody representing Christianity there?
Well, that's a funny thing, Dr. Stan. I just have entered into some of those groups, and as I said, I worshipped at the center one time, and I've been with those people a couple of times just because I wanted to understand what they were saying. And the two key times when I was part of a discussion, actually I wasn't part of the discussion, I sat either at the back or on the edge, and I was quiet until the very end when I said, but you're saying that you're representing all the religions, Buddhism, Islam, various witches, witchcraft, all the different kinds of paganism, Native American spirituality. And I said, there isn't anybody who represents my form of Christianity. And they looked stunned because, of course, you had the Episcopal leaders, you had Catholic leaders, you had Methodist leaders in these groups who call themselves Christian, but none of them believed in the cross or in the salvation that Christ won for us. They have put that aside. Just as it's interesting when you look at, for example, Reverend Moon, head of the Moonies, owner of Washington Times, who said, let me just see here. Here's a statement he made. He said, this is an article about him, and it says, an interfaith group founded by Unification Church leader Sun Yung Myung Moon is spearheading an effort to have Christian ministers to remove crosses from the churches, calling them a symbol of oppression and perceived superiority. The cross, here's what he said, the cross has served as a barrier in bringing about the true spirit of reconciliation between Jews and also between Muslims and Christians, and thus we have sought to remove the cross from Christian churches across America. As a sign of our willingness to remove any barrier that stands in the way of us coming together as a people of faith. Well, in those two times that I went into those interfaith groups and just sat and listened, they were shocked when they finally spoke up, like, where did you come from? I didn't know there were people like you around anymore. They couldn't believe it. They are so involved in their own group, listening to all the voices that agree with them, that they don't seem to realize that they do not represent biblical Christianity, as if they left that behind a long time ago. And that's the kind of letters that we get to our website, Dr. Stan. People are saying, I can't believe you still exist. I thought, that your kind of Christianity was done away with 50 years ago. An awful lot of people are believing that. We're becoming, to many, very strange misfits in this new globalized society. And we need to speak up, and this is why it was so important that Judge Moore spoke up, took a stand, claimed what his obligation was, because he made the vow to uphold the Alabama Constitution, which proclaimed God and called for the judges to do so. He was being honest and true to what he believed. He was being honest and true to what he had sworn to do, and we need to do that too, but it's going to be increasingly difficult because we're living in a post-Christian culture where even churches are willing to go along with setting aside the cross and setting aside the fundamental belief that separates biblical Christianity from all the other conformist forms of Christianity and the other religions of the world, and all of them can blend together if you take out the cross and you take out the gospel.
Well, I think that people have to understand we're really involved in a spiritual battle. being fought on a political and ideological and cultural and economic and educational battlefield, and the average individual doesn't even know the battle's going on. But there are only really two religions in the world. There's Christianity and there's all the others, and there are many, many branches of all the others, the Muslim faith. Well, of course, we can put Judaism, at least on our side of the ledger, because Christianity came out of the cradle of Judaism. But, of course, it's certainly not the same at all, because, of course, we're waiting for the Messiah to return again, and the Jews are waiting for the Messiah to come. I fear that the Messiah they're waiting for is indeed the Antichrist.
Right.
But
right.
God has a plan for the Jews, and at least many of them, I do believe, in the end times will accept him. In fact, it's exciting. As I run into Messianic Jews, there seem to be more and more of them all the time.
Right. And God said that would happen, didn't he? And that's exciting. I want to go back for just a moment to UNESCO's declaration on the role of religion in the promotion of a culture of peace. We have a section on that at our website, but if I can just summarize a couple of points, because going back to what we discussed at the very beginning, that the Supreme Court judges like Ginsburg and Breyer are choosing to base their opinions, their legal opinions, on European law and precedents, and especially in the area of morality and behavior. And here's what, you know, of course, that, and they also have talked about the United Nations, and so it might be good just to see what United Nations says about religion specifically.
All right, what do they say, Barrett?
They say, religion have led to division, hatred, and war. Peace entails that we understand that we're all interdependent, collectively responsible for the common good. And of course, they define the common good. And then they say we should distinguish fanaticism from religious zeal, and we are defined as fanatics, of course, by other many, many documents that they have presented. We will favor peace. This is UNESCO. We will favor peace by countering the tendencies of individuals and communities to assume or even to teach that they are inherently superior to others. And, of course, that means that you cannot say that our God, the biblical God, the creator of the universe, is better or superior to any of the other gods that the world has chosen to worship. It says we will promote dialogue and harmony between and within religions. And this is why the United Nations and that particular conference in Istanbul on human settlements called for worship centers in the center of each group of buildings so that they can have dialogue between the religions, respecting, they say, the search for truth and wisdom that's outside of our own religion. We will establish dialogue with all, striving for a sincere fellowship. We will build a culture of peace based on nonviolence, tolerance, dialogue, mutual understanding, and justice. And we call upon the institutions of our civil society, governments, governmental and non-governmental organizations, corporations, and the mass media to strengthen their commitment to peace and listen to the cries of the victims. We call upon the different religious and cultural traditions to join hands and to cooperate with us. Those are the guidelines. Those are the legal guidelines as far as United Nations is concerned. And, of course, it's become soft law that's being implemented into hard law in all throughout Europe, because this is a foundational belief for the kinds of edicts and laws that are being passed in Canada, in UK, in Belarus, in Eastern Europe, all these different, France and so on, all these countries that are actually putting into their legal, into their laws, their federal laws, the kind of guidelines that will ban the teaching of biblical Christianity to the young, to the elderly, to anybody, because they consider it exclusive and divisive.
Yeah, of course, I think the important thing is that the religion that they're teaching is one where we decide what's right and wrong. And when man decides what's right and wrong, he's going, of course, to go the wrong way. That's
right.
Why we need God's rules and God's laws. And that's, of course, the beauty of the Judeo-Christian religion, thou shalt not, thou shalt not, thou shalt not.
Right.
And, of course, the other religion, Lucifer's religion, says, do what thou wilt. That is the whole of the law. You be the decider. That's what we're teaching our kids in school today. That's what they want. And, of course, when that happens, you have moral chaos.
Absolutely. And when you have moral chaos, you have government control. Absolute control of every person.
And those who will not be ruled by God will be ruled by tyrants. Well, time is running out for America, and the question is, are there enough people out there who really care, who will join us in this epic struggle to determine whether this nation or any nation under God can long endure? We've got Jeannie on the line. Hi, Jeannie. How are you doing?
Good evening. And Barrett, it's good to hear your voice.
Thank you, Jeannie.
I downloaded from the Internet, it's Earth Dialogues, and it was a meeting by Mikhail Gorbachev and Marie Strong. And the title was Globalization and Sustainable Development. Is ethics the missing link? But they talked about the religions, and this is just one sentence I wanted to mention. They said the world religions must identify those elements that contribute to extreme fundamentalism, and we must eradicate them.
That means eliminate them, I suppose. That'll be the camp or the firing squad.
Right. And if you look that up again, they've taken that out of their report. But I did download that.
Oh, thank you. Will you get me a copy of that?
I will, Dr. Stan.
Can you too, Jeannie?
Yes.
Thank you. I am working on an article right now on mental health. Actually, it's going to be a series of articles, but it's amazing when you read the laws concerning mental health as it was established first by Bauchism through the World Health Organization, and to now look how that ideology, that the founding ideology, which was so anti-Christian, against the poisonous certainties, against those who have absolute faith and who won't conform, in how the documents from Canada and other countries are talking about in the concept of mental health, from government documents, from their, whatever they call their federal institution, for, like what would be the comparable to our Department of Health and Human Services, they talk about doing away with barriers, all the barriers to implementing their program for mental health. And of course, mental health is not dealing with, it deals with schizophrenia and paranoia and so on, but that's beside the point. The key is the mental health of the whole population, conforming every person to the new guidelines for how you are to believe, what you must tolerate, how you must dialogue together and be part of the community and consider the greater whole and stop and put aside any of the traditional barriers that keeps you from flowing with the crowd into this new society where everybody has to think alike.
And Barrett, it seems so incredible that anybody would really want to do this, and yet there are these elite people who worship a different god or dream a different dream, who are in the process of implementing this not only here but throughout the world.
Could you mention Barrett's website, please, again?
Crossroad.to, crossroad.to. And if you haven't been there, why, you've missed an awful lot, Jeannie.
Let me just mention that Crossroad is singular. Some people add an S to it. And so it's just Crossroad without any S at the end. And then T-O is T like in Tom and O like in Oscar.
Well, I have two of my favorite guests on the line. But right now, God bless you both, because we're out of time. God bless you both. Thank
God
you so
bless
much.
You, Dr. Stan.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Okay, fine. Well, this is Dr. Stan. This is the time I have to remind our listeners that Radio Liberty is listener-supported. We do hope that many of you out there will give serious consideration to joining the Radio Liberty family of supporters. And if you'd like a free copy of our newsletter, why, of course, we'll be glad to send you one. Give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-1. And, of course, when you join the Radio Liberty family, you get our letter and you get our four best tapes of the month automatically. So until tomorrow, when we'll be back with you again, Dr. Stan, good night, and may the Lord be with you. Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. We welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or here on the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295, but please hold your calls for the time being, because we have with us, hopefully, very, very shortly, Randy Thomason from the Campaign for California Families. Randy, how are you tonight?
Hi, Dr. Stan. Is your voice scratchy?
No, it's, why did you say that? Does it sound scratchy? No, I'm recovering from laryngitis.
Uh-huh, well, I guess I get to do a little more talking then.
Well, you always do. You go ahead.
Hi. Well, I'm a little down tonight. There was a Governor Gray Davis of California has signed the transsexual foster care bill. Governor Gray Davis has essentially declared war on foster parents all over the state, two-thirds of them estimated to be people of faith. And I'm afraid that foster parents are going to quit rather than submit to this sensitivity training, that they must be told that they're legally responsible to support homosexual, bisexual, and transsexual behavior among foster children in their care. And it's just an attack upon what is good. These are confused children who have been sexually molested. That's why they think that they're a boy when they're a girl or a girl when they're a boy. And, you know, this is going to shut the mouths of Christian foster parents. So I'm very sad to tell you that. It's another reason to vote to kick the bum out.
All right. Anything else, Randy?
Well, yes. This was a double whammy, finding that out today. And then today, the California State Assembly, controlled by Democrats, passed the sex survey bill. This is SB 71, which basically attacks abstinence education and attacks parental rights in schools in one fell swoop. The bill would authorize government schools to ask any sex questions imaginable.
Well, that's another reason why every parent who loves their children will get them out of government schools. If that won't do it, what will it take?
I'll tell you. I hope it doesn't take their kid being molested. I sure hope not. There's all these problems because you've got the Democrats who are in league with the Parent Teachers Association. The PTA supports this. The teachers union, the nurses union, Cruz Bustamante supports this bill. SB 71 passed today. The Republicans actually did a very good job in rare form. 16 out of 32 Republicans rose up and spoke against this bill. Twice as many Republicans spoke as Democrats did. And so that was impressive. And I thought that we were going to win, but we ended up losing by 3 votes. 44 out of 48 Democrats voted for this bad bill, apparently not caring about parental rights. And the conscience of these Democrats, you know, I'm thinking, what do we, they want us to call them Democrats that they don't know? Well, they heard the whole debate, they can read, they know that this is squashing parental rights to give sex surveys to kids without written parental consent. They're wiping out a parental right in the law. And so if we can't call them Democrats or Democrats, well, some have suggested call them Demoncrats.
All right, I'll go along with that, because, of course, this is a spiritual battle.
Now, some may think that that's too harsh.
No, I don't think it's all at all. I think you're being very kind.
Well, if people believe that God exists, and those who go against what God has created are in league with the powers of darkness, then I think that's perhaps exactly what we're seeing.
Well, I think that we really need to start bringing this out, Randy. Maybe that will get to some of the people out there who say, oh, nothing bad's ever going to happen to me or my children because God's in control. Well, I believe that God is in control, but not the God of the Bible.
Well, I'll tell you, the Bible says that in the epistles of John, that the whole earth is under the control or the sway of the evil one. And we are told to stand up for what is right. We are told to stand up for truth. And Dr. Stan, you do that as long as I've known you. You've been standing up for what you see as true, even when it's unpopular. And my hat is off to you, and I will pray that you get over this laryngitis. I hope you're drinking some hot tea with a little bit of honey or whatever your doctor's experience tells you is best.
Right. Well, I do what Dr. Barbara says, so.
I've met Dr. Barbara. She takes good care of you.
She sure does. Well, anything else that we want to talk about? I understand that Peter Uberoff has dropped out of a race now. It's really Schwarzenegger and McClintock and Bustamante, isn't it?
Right.
Now, what are the polls showing? Is it Bustamante way ahead, or?
Well, I think that what this means at this point with Uberoth out of the race, McClintock is staying in. McClintock is the principled one. He's a generally pro-family conservative. He will stand to protect family and the pocketbook. He's the only major candidate to have signed the marriage protection pledge to protect marriage and the vote of the people. And you have Arnold Schwarzenegger in league with Cruz Bustamante, supporting undermining marriage, and both supporting homosexual adoption, and both Bustamante and Schwarzenegger supporting abortion on demand. And I think in this unique time where there can be the next governor elected with a simple plurality, not majority, but a plurality of votes, the next governor of California could win with 30-35%. And it's really a three-man race, I believe. McClintock is actually rising in the polls, while Bustamante and Schwarzenegger have remained fairly stagnant. And there's going to be more information exposing Bustamante and Schwarzenegger as time goes out. And I think that that this is a time for all people who love their state to get involved now and support their favorite candidate in the governor's race.
All right, fine. Well, thank you so much, Brad. If you want to get your address out so people can get in touch with you.
Well, actually, it's Randy.
I'm sorry. You too, Randy.
Yes. Well,
look at the screen. Brad's on the other line.
Well, yes.
Brad's listening out there now.
Hello to Brad.
Laughing.
Well, listen. Visit us on the line at on the web at SaveCalifornia.com. SaveCalifornia.com. Sign up for free email updates. We're fighting for you. Brad is fighting for you out there. And thank you for you.
God bless you. Bye, bye,
okay,
Randy.
Bye, bye.
Okay, hi, Brad. How you doing?
Oh, doing great, Dr. Stanley.
Tell me what's going on.
Well, we've got, amidst all this political turmoil that Randy was just talking about, we've got a little bit of a nice victory to report. In the city of Manteca, they decided to keep a church from using a facility downtown, a storefront, and a church called Common Ground Church, and a wonderful, loving church. And so we were contacted our legal counsel, and we prepared to file our appeal in court and challenge this this terrible decision. And the good news is the final demand letter, the city went 180 degrees and went ahead and approved the church and no longer is requiring it to have its conditional use permit. And it's just another example of the incredible, although politically we've got some great uncertainties, one thing we do see is an incredible wave of building to totally break down these barriers with cities. And I think we're going to see, Dr. Stanley, an explosion of church growth and development that we have not seen in decades. And we at the Pacific Justice Institute are just excited to be playing a major role in being a part of that.
Well, you are playing a major role in it, and God bless you for what you do.
Oh, thank you, Dr. Stanley. And
let's get your website and telephone number out there for our listeners.
You bet. Our website is simply pacificjustice.org. That's pacificjustice.org. And our toll-free number is 888 888- 888-305-9129, 888-305-9129, and we'll be praying for you and your voice, okay?
Thanks so much, Brad. God bless.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Okay, that was Brad Dacus, and now we're, of course, going to get on the line David Wade. And he's written a book called Infamy Revisited. It's the story of Pearl Harbor, and I think it's really so significant as we come upon the second anniversary of September 11th. And we know that certainly in 1941, the American people did not want to go to war in Europe or with Japan. But our leaders did. In the year 2001, why the American people didn't want to go to war in the Middle East, but our leaders did. The decision had already been made. And those of you who have not gone to the PNAC website, the Project for the New American Century, go to that website. It's newamericancentury.org. That's www.newamericancentury.org. And if you pull it down and you read the 1998 letter that they sent to President Clinton at that time, why, of course, they're calling for a war with Iraq. In the year 2000, they put out a report calling for war with Iraq. The decision was made long before the terrorist attack. The terrorist attack was not the reason, the real reason we're going to war in the Middle East. We're going to war in the Middle East because we are going to station our troops there permanently. We are going to remake that part of the world. That's what it's all about. That's what this $87 billion, and that's just one of the down payments on this effort at nation building. Why, if we've liberated the country, if we've done away with Saddam Hussein, why do we want to rebuild the nation? Why not let them rebuild the nation? Oh, no, 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 no. We have to install a democracy there. We don't have a democracy in the United States. Why do we want to install a democracy over there? They always lead to a dictatorship. Plato wrote that, in the Republic 2,300 years ago, and it always happens. Democracies always result in despotism, as they did in Hitler's Germany and Benito Mussolini's Italy, and as they are increasingly doing here in America today, as we turn from a republic to a democracy. Well, we've got with us David Wade, and David, thank you so much for being with us this evening.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here.
And, of course, this is an entirely different audience, so don't hesitate at all to repeat what you said earlier. So how did you get interested in Pearl Harbor, and what have you learned as you've studied this, other than the fact that much of the information about Pearl Harbor is still classified so the American people can't find out the truth?
Well, I got interested in Pearl Harbor because I was of the post-war generation. I was born a couple of years after the war actually ended. But all of the fathers of my friends had served in the armed forces during the Second World War, and it was a constant topic of conversation among them. And it was perhaps the most real historic event in my life as a young man growing up in a small Midwestern town. And I later became interested in history in general and majored in history at DePaul University in Chicago, and decided to write a book about Pearl Harbor after I had myself read about 20 different books on it. And this book is really a compilation of the results of my research. And I learned an enormous amount about Pearl Harbor.
All right, well, why don't you tell us basically what you did learn? Do you think it's really true that we wanted the war, that we knew the attack was coming, and we allowed those the attack to take place?
Oh, yes. If you look at it in the broad context of President Roosevelt's diplomacy, there's no doubt that we wanted a war with the Japanese, and we did everything to provoke it. I think mainly because Roosevelt calculated correctly that if he got us into a war with Japan, inevitably a war with Germany, Japan's ally, would follow. And what he wanted mainly was to get us into that war so that we would have a decisive hand at the making of world peace. It was the beginning of a new world order in which the United States, in conjunction with the Soviet Union, would in effect be the joint policeman for the world. This was Roosevelt's vision. But he had to get us into the Second World War in order to fulfill that vision.
Well, now, how did he get us into the war? I mean, we might ask the people today, how did they get us into a war in Iraq? Well, how did they get us into the Second World War? How did they get the Japanese to attack? And, of course, why didn't they warn the people at Pearl Harbor so that they could have protected themselves?
The short answer to how they got us into the war is contained in a memo that was written on the 7th of October, 1940 by Arthur H. McCollum, Lieutenant Commander, United States Navy, and personal friend of Franklin D. Roosevelt. This memo was one of the documents unearthed by Robert Stinnett in research for his book, Day of Deceit, The Truth About FDR and Pearl Harbor. We haven't known about this until Stinnett wrote his book. It was an 8-point memo outlining exactly what the United States should do to provoke Japan to attack us, and McCollum said so in so many words. We want war with Japan. This is what we should do. And Roosevelt followed that memo. It included provoking Japan by moving the American Pacific Fleet from its ports in California to Pearl Harbor, violating Japanese territorial waters with special patrols of American ships, and instituting a blockade and embargo against Japan of materiel, especially oil, which would be necessary to the Japanese war machine. This memo is of crucial importance. In addition to that, the Roosevelt administration was also following a policy of refusing to seriously negotiate with Japan over its invasion of China, and was making, shall we say, non-negotiable demands against the Japanese, which included the total withdrawal within 1 year period of all Japanese forces from China, which the Japanese interpreted as also including their conquest of Manchuria, or Manchukuo as they called it, and also the demand that Japan break the tripartite agreement it had with Mussolini and Hitler, and isolate itself diplomatically from the rest of the world. These were demands that the Japanese could not meet. That, on top of the oil embargo, proved too much. It provoked Japan into attacking the United States.
But of course,
it was exactly its intention.
Yeah, right. And so then we knew the attack was coming on Pearl Harbor. How did they know where the attack was coming?
Oh, there were many sources. We knew the attack was coming on Pearl Harbor because we had, in fact, intercepted Japanese radio transmissions. The Japanese attack force, Kido Butai, that was making its way across the northern Pacific headed towards Hawaii, had been ordered to maintain radio silence, but we now know that it did not for various reasons. And there were some 71 intercepts from that fleet between the time it left Japanese home waters on the 25th of December up to and including the 6th of December, the day before the attack, which were, in fact, intercepted. They were intercepted by Station Cast on the island of Corregidor in the Philippines, and they were transmitted from there to a station Hypo, which was our listening post in Hawaii. The assumption was that they would then be transmitted to Admiral Kimmel, who was the commander of the American fleet at Pearl Harbor. Mysteriously, they were not. But we know that they were transmitted to Washington, D.C. and to Franklin D. Roosevelt. There was a huge Japanese fleet out there. It was headed across the Pacific toward Hawaii, and our naval base at Pearl Harbor would have been the only logical target.
And, of course, the day before, December 6th, why they knew it was right off the northwest shore of Oahu Island. And what was that story? How did we know that what they knew at that time?
Well, we knew that because of the transmissions that were intercepted by our naval district in San Francisco. And the commander of intelligence at that naval district was Richard T. McCullough, not to be confused with Arthur McCullum, another naval officer and another personal friend of Franklin D. Roosevelt's, who had the private phone number of Roosevelt's confidant, Harry Hopkins, who was living with Roosevelt in the White House. And McCullough signaled his intention to inform the White House to one of his subordinates, a man by the name of Robert Ogg, who lived long enough to tell his tale to Stinnett. And we now know, therefore, that there was a direct and immediate link between this intelligence and President Roosevelt himself.
But, of course, we also know that the was either Danish or Swedish naval attaché went into the war room there, at where was it, somewhere in Washington, D.C., and actually saw the map where they
The Office of Naval Intelligence. Right. That was Johan Oranheft, and he was actually jointly representing the governments of Holland and Sweden, who were negotiating patent rights on the manufacture of an anti-aircraft gun, and he just happened to wander into the wrong room, and he saw a conference going on. There were high-ranking naval intelligence officers all sitting around a desk, and another one who was lecturing them, pointing at a map with a pointer, saying, "The Japanese fleet is here," and indicating a position just outside of Hawaii and moving rapidly in that direction, as he also indicated with his pointer. This is anecdotal evidence that there were all sorts of people in the Office of Naval Intelligence who knew not only that the Japanese were going to attack us, but when they were going to attack us and where they were going to attack us.
And, of course, the significant thing is John Toland, who wrote the book Infamy, actually checked, I think it was with the Dutch the Foreign Office, and was able to go back and actually get the note that the attaché had sent over there on December 6th, giving this story. So this is not simply a hearsay story. There was actual documentation of it.
There was very actual documentation.
They knew where the Japanese fleet was. They knew when the attack was coming, and they did absolutely nothing to stop it.
Right. We can't emphasize the importance of that too much. Of course, because of Roosevelt's diplomacy, it was known to Washington insiders that there was going to be war with Japan, and nobody quarrels with that, but there are people who continue to deny that we knew that they were going to attack Pearl Harbor when and where they did. The evidence is now accumulated to indicate that we knew that too.
All right, fine. So then, of course, we knew because we were reading their codes, weren't we?
We were reading their codes. We had broken the Japanese diplomatic code. We had broken a part of the JN-25 code, which was the Japanese naval code. That was even more significant. We were tracking Japanese ships all over the world. We had also tapped into Japanese diplomatic traffic. And this is important because we knew the conversations that were going on, for instance, between the Japanese ambassador to Berlin, Admiral Oshima, and the foreign minister of Nazi Germany, Joachim von Ribbentrop. And we know that Oshima had pledged his word to them that they were going to attack the United States. And we know that Hitler had said that if that happens, Germany would join the war against America, which, of course, is exactly what Roosevelt wanted.
And, of course, the thing was that didn't the Japanese send a declaration of war to their ambassador in Washington, D.C. with a specific time to deliver that to the president?
Yes, the Japanese sent a 14-part message, which was being relayed one part at a time to the Japanese ambassador in Washington, D.C., Ambassador Nomura, and his assistant, Ambassador Caruso, Special Envoy. This message, the last part of it, was delayed in its arrival and did not get to Washington, D.C. until after the attack actually began. wasn't until the entire message had been received that the Japanese delivered it to our Secretary of State, Cordell Hull, and therefore it looked like the Japanese had actually attacked us before delivering their formal declaration of war, but that wasn't the way it was planned. It was planned so that the declaration of war would arrive shortly before the attack. But this too served Roosevelt's purposes, of course, because it made it look like the Japanese had in fact executed a sneak attack and had attacked us without a formal declaration of war. That made it all the easier for Roosevelt to rally public opinion in favor of an immediate declaration of war against Japan, which he did the very next day on the 8th of December.
All right, fine. So, of course, then Roosevelt knew ahead of time. He'd read the intercepts. He knew that there was going to be the attack. He knew it was in Japan. I mean, knew it was in Pearl Harbor. And they knew the approximate time because they knew the time that the declaration was going to be of war was going to be presented to them, and it would correspond to 7 o'clock in the morning in Pearl Harbor.
Mm-hmm.
So then they got that information to George Catlett Marshall, the Army Chief of Staff. It was up to him, of course, to warn everybody that the attack was coming and where it was coming. So tell that story, would you, David?
Well, it's almost a comic opera episode. The evening before, Naval Commander Elwin Kramer was scurrying around Washington, D.C., trying to find somebody in a position of authority to warn Pearl Harbor of the impending attack, and he was unable to do so. It happened that Admiral Stark, who was Chief of Naval Operations, was at the theater attending a performance of The Student Prince, and Roosevelt was notified, but he refused to contact Stark because he didn't want to upset members of the audience. The next morning, Kramer's counterpart in the Army, Colonel Rufus Bratton, went looking for Marshall. He also had the intelligence of the impending attack, and Marshall would be a person who would have the authority to notify Pearl Harbor. Well, Marshall went out for a horse ride that morning in the park and couldn't be found. Disappeared for a couple of hours. He finally came back to his office. Bratton confronted him. He said, "Look, we have the final 14th segment of this 14-part message, and Japan is definitely going to attack us. We're going to be at war any minute now." Marshall refused to pick up his scrambler telephone and call Pearl Harbor because he was afraid that the Japanese would intercept the phone call. That seems to me like an extremely lame excuse. What difference did it make since we were going to be at war very shortly anyway? take the risk of having the telephone message intercepted under those emergency circumstances, but he refused to do it. He refused also to use the radio, the Department of Defense radio broadcast, claiming that it had broken down and couldn't be used. So he wrote out a handwritten message which was conveyed by way of landline to San Francisco and from San Francisco to Hawaii by way of Western Union. And a Western Union courier, a boy on a bicycle, delivered it to Admiral Kimmel's staff. But by that time, the Japanese had already attacked and the fleet was at the bottom of Pearl Harbor. Marshall's conduct under these circumstances has always seemed extremely mysterious. And as a matter of fact, as it turned out, although Marshall claimed that the Army Broadcasting Network had broken down, that same broadcasting network was used to convey a war warning to General MacArthur the same morning, and that message got through without any problem. Very strange. That's never been explained. Marshall testified to that before Congress, but his own explanation of his conduct is a masterpiece of evasion and confusion.
All right, we're going to be back here in just a moment, and we'll welcome your calls at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Thank you. this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest, David Wade, his book, Infamy Revisited. If you'd like to know about more about that, you can give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. We also have a four-tape set on the Pearl Harbor. We have a wonderful book, another great book, Dave Deceit, but Infamy Revisited, easy reading, and it's written by our special guest this evening, David Wade. So, David, of course, the thing is that everything was done. They knew the attack was coming. They knew when it was coming. And they specifically did not order, pardon me, they did not warn Admiral Kimmel so he could put his fleet to sea. At least they wouldn't have been sunk there at Pearl Harbor, and some of the ships might have escaped.
Admiral Kimmel and General Short, the commander of the land forces at Pearl Harbor, were both left out of the loop. Admiral Kimmel had been ordered, in fact, not to take the fleet out of Pearl Harbor. He had ordered the fleet out on maneuvers, and he was told by the Department of the Navy to return his fleet to Pearl Harbor and to keep it there until further orders. So his hands were tied. There was also an order that was issued called the Vacant Seas Order, which cleared from the Northern Pacific all vessels flying the American flag. And in fact, there were some Russian merchant vessels that were requested to reroute themselves so that they did not go through this area of the Pacific too. And that seems to be a deliberate attempt to keep any ships out of the path of the Japanese strike force so that their presence could not be detected. There are just so many suspicious things that were done. But one thing that stands out is the way that Admiral Kimmel was specifically singled out and kept out of the loop. He was not allowed to see purple code decrypts. He was not given the decrypts from JN-25, the Japanese naval code that were decrypted in the Philippines and sent to Hawaii. All this information was kept from him, and he was ordered to stay in Pearl Harbor until further orders.
And of course, what's really so interesting, if you read Admiral Kimmel's story, written by Admiral Kimmel, he tells you how he was getting these letters from Stark, who was Chief of Naval Operations in Washington, telling him that the attack would come in the Philippines, that it would not come at Pearl Harbor, when they knew it was going to come at Pearl Harbor. So they left him there, and of course then they took all the aircraft carriers away because they didn't want to get those sunk, and they really felt that the battleships would not be a great loss. In other words, if we sacrifice the battleships, we'll have the carriers, we have the rest of our fleet intact, but we need an incident to get into the war, and they left those boys to die. That's what's so unconscionable.
Yes, and as a matter of fact, they were right about the battleships because there were only two battleships that were irreparably lost, and one of them, of course, was the Arizona. 1,000 sailors were simply blown to bits when the Arizona was sunk, and the other battleship was the Oklahoma. But the others suffered minor damage and were later raised. So, the sacrifice of the fleet at Pearl Harbor was actually minimal, although the loss of life was heavy. There were 2,403 military personnel who were killed and another 1,178 wounded, to be exact. So there was a tremendous loss of life, but the aircraft carriers were spared, and most of the battleships that were sunk were actually raised again.
So, of course, the real message here is the government knew the attack was coming and did nothing to stop it. That is what's unconscionable, and did nothing to warn the military there in Hawaii that the attack was coming. Otherwise, they could have limited the loss of life considerably. Now, what happened on September 11th has been likened to a Pearl Harbor. Would you like to comment on that?
Well, first of all, I think that there will be years of recrimination about September 11th, just as there has been about Pearl Harbor. There have been many investigations into Pearl Harbor, And we still don't know all the facts because the government is still sitting on a lot of classified information which has yet to be released that could be of critical significance. And this is likely to happen with September 11th as well. And there have already been people who have raised questions about our prior knowledge of that attack and whether, in fact, our failure to react is a result of bureaucratic bungling or perhaps it was the result of deliberately letting the attack happen because we were looking for a pretext to get us into a war against terror with the ultimate object, of course, being not Osama bin Laden, as it turns out, but the regime in Iraq and Saddam Hussein.
And of course,
the ultimate target for Roosevelt was not Japan, but Germany.
You know, that's really so interesting because, you know, why didn't we finish the war in Afghanistan? Why didn't we capture al-Qaeda? Why didn't we capture Osama bin Laden? Why did we leave that nation after destroying the legitimate government there in total chaos and immediately turn to Iraq? And I think it should be obvious to anybody really thinking about it, that was always our motive to begin with. In other words, Afghanistan was not our real target.
Well, I think this can be well documented. Yeah, that can be well documented that there was and is a coterie in the State Department. There are people who were involved in the Bush campaign. There is Condoleezza Rice, and there is Douglas Feith, and there is Richard Perle, and Elliot Abramson, and a whole host of others who believed from the very beginning that they ought to finish the job that the first President Bush began. And there's a paper trail. There are memos that were written. There are articles that were published expounding this idea before September 11th, years before September 11th, even before George W. Bush was elected president. A war against Iraq, I think, was in the works.
I think you're absolutely right, and I think the tragedy is the average American doesn't know that. And, you know, as you listen to the mainline media, they never tell you about the Project for the New American Century. You can go to their website, and you can actually see their writings in 1998
yes.
calling for a war with Iraq. And who were these people? Don Rumsfeld, Dick Cheney, Paul Wolfowitz.
Paul Wolfowitz,
the same
yes,
old
that's
suspect.
A key man that I neglected to mention, yes. It seems to me that the whole thing was opportunistic. Because, you know, the American people can be so easily confused. I read a public opinion poll once that said 60% of the American people had difficulty distinguishing between Osama bin Laden and Saddam Hussein. They thought that they were one and the same, joined at the hip, or maybe even the same person called by different names. So, all they know is that, you know, they're Arabs and they're Saddam Hussein is a tyrant, and they are told that there was some kind of connection between Osama bin Laden and Saddam Hussein, so it was all one and the same thing, so what the heck? Let's go to war with Iraq and
well,
get those terrorists.
Our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295 if you're in the Monterey Bay area. 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295 if you agree. You disagree, why give us a call? Well, I think that it should be very obvious that this war with Iraq was planned. Oh, we are not going to pull our troops out. I talked to a gentleman just today who was going to be going over there as a civilian. He had to sign a contract for 5 years. And that's probably the first stage. I think that our troops will be there for 50 years. And, of course, this will be used as a stepping-off place for other wars in that area. And if Iran doesn't crumble from within, we will go to war with Iran. If Syria doesn't crumble from within, we'll go to war with Syria. And we're entering the war state. Well, let's see. We've got somebody on the line here, and let's see who that is. It looks like, is that Mike? Hi, Mike. How are you doing?
Yeah, hi, Stan. Great show tonight. Regarding the planning of this war and how they've been telling us without telling us for so long, if you remember back when Vietnam finished, and within, I think, about 2 years, they were telling us that they were preparing for desert warfare, changing over from jungle warfare. They knew that the wars of the future were going to be in desert countries, and they were changing their camouflage and machinery and just about everything imaginable.
Back in the early 90s, the White Carlisle Corporation bought the rights to the Bradley fighting vehicle and the mobile howitzer. Now, these are both things that you would use in desert warfare. Who is Carlisle? Why, it's James Baker III, Frank Carlucci, George Herbert Walker Bush. And, of course, why would they be buying, the Bradley fighting vehicle? Because in the early 90s, we thought wars were over, you know, the Berlin Wall had come down, and war was going to be a thing of the past.
Well, what I'm talking about goes back to 75 or 76.
Sure, I think it's long-term planning. You're absolutely right.
Yeah. Okay, that's all. Thanks.
Okay, thanks so much, Mike.
Mm-hmm. And there is an interesting parallel with the events leading up to Pearl Harbor there, too, because, as a matter of fact, we, and when I say we, I mean our Department of Defense, had already drawn up plans for an invasion of Europe before the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor, which specifically called for an invasion of France, which was scheduled for July of 1942. Very elaborate and detailed plans, which were somehow taken from the safe of Colonel Elbert Wedemeyer, and the plans were printed by the Chicago Tribune, and that caused an enormous stir at the time. Roosevelt War Plans! Exclamation point. But these documents did, in fact, turn out to be authentic. We were already planning for an invasion of Europe months before Pearl Harbor.
Well, you know, I had the opportunity to spend several weekends with General Albert Wedemeyer. He ended up a four-star general.
Yes, he did. Yeah, he was a colonel at the time.
And, of course, he told me, and we eventually found out who stole the plans. Roosevelt did. And he published them.
Yes, I was going to mention that because there was a biography of the publisher of the Chicago Tribune, written by Richard Norton Smith. He wrote a book called The Colonel, Life and Legend of Robert R. McCormick, and he thinks that McCormick was a victim of a Roosevelt plot, that Roosevelt himself ordered the plan stolen and given to McCormick, knowing that McCormick, being an inveterate political foe of Roosevelt's, would publish them, and that would make McCormick look like he was being unpatriotic.
And of course,
and it would actually hurt McCormick.
The other reason was because they wanted to infuriate Adolf Hitler with that, and which it, of course, did, and of course, because they wanted Adolf Hitler to declare war on the United States, which, of course, he did.
Mm-hmm.
So let's go to Jeff, who is calling. Where are you calling from, Jeff?
Hi, Stan. This is Jim from San
Diego. Oh, Jim. Okay. Good to have you with us.
Hi, guys. Good. You guys are really putting out a lot of important information tonight, especially the similarities between Pearl Harbor and 9/11, I think, is really important and something that people need to think about. I think that in regards, you know, I just wanted to mention, Stan, you were talking about George Bush's speech and the policy in Iraq, and the one thing I noticed about the speech is that President Bush didn't set forth any plan to get out, as far as I know.
No, he didn't.
I mean, basically, all the speech came down to was he's begging for more money. There was speculation that he might finally be able to produce some evidence about the vaunted weapons of mass destruction. There was none of that. Matter of fact, they seemed to want to change that topic.
Well, I think what's really the current line is we're really there, we're fighting terrorism. And, of course, they're bringing in terrorists from all over the world there to fight us because they know how important it is that they defeat us there.
Yes.
And, of course, because all the terrorists are converging on Iraq, then we're not going to have to face them on the street.
Well, you see, that's a really remarkable thing because now they're turning that around and they're trying to use that as an argument, as a retroactive justification for their war because they said two things. First, Saddam Hussein has weapons of mass destruction. And second, he's connected with Al-Qaeda. Now they're saying, well, there's the proof that he's connected with Al-Qaeda. Well, he is. Saddam Hussein has been forced out of power and has now gone underground. But if it had not been for the American invasion, Iraq would not have become a rallying point for world terrorism.
You're absolutely right.
And moving into the country now. Because we have to remember, after all, Iraq is a Muslim country, and we are foreigners. We are from a foreign nation and also from an alien culture. And this has provoked the sort of reaction that you think would have been predictable.
I think it was predictable. Anything else, Jim?
Yeah, there is one other thing I just wanted to comment in line with what you guys are talking about. Are you still there?
Sure.
Okay, I heard a question. You know, in regard to 9/11 and prior knowledge, you know, I just wanted to point out, as you guys are well aware, that since 1947, our government has had the most elaborate national security state ever assembled in the history of the world. And we have been, for the last 50 years or more, actively involved in the Arab world in various ways and doing things there that they don't like. The Arabs have been shaking their fists at us for years. They've been warning us. There have been prior terrorist attacks against the United States and against U.S. interests in other parts of the world. The idea that they couldn't see this coming on 9/11, you know, in the big picture, I just find it impossible to believe.
Well, I think you're absolutely right, but of course, they cannot let the American people know that they knew the attack was coming and they did nothing to stop it.
Well, what have we got? We got the CIA. We've got the Office of Naval Intelligence. We've got the National Reconnaissance Office. We've got the Defense Intelligence Agency.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I know that, and we got the National Security Agency. We've got all these huge organizations that we pour billions and billions of dollars into. We got a intelligence net across the globe. And, you know, I just can't believe these people when they come and they get on TV and tell me that they didn't see this coming. I think the fact that they couldn't anticipate it or deal with it, I think in itself is criminal, really.
No, wait a minute. I think that they could anticipate it. I believe that they knew it was coming, and they did nothing to stop it. And the reason I do that is because of Kristen Breitweiss's testimony before the select committee of the combined House and Senate committee that was on September 18th of the year 2002. That testimony was deleted from the report when it was published, but she pointed out that according to the New York Times, within 2 hours of the attack, why FBI agents were at the restaurants where some of the hijackers ate, at the neighborhoods where they lived, at the training schools, flight schools where they train now, if they had no idea there was going to be an attack, they had no idea who these people were, how could they possibly have done that within 2 hours?
Yeah.
And then, of course, the other thing is within 2 days, they had arrested 1,200 people here. Now, there are 6 million Muslims in America, but they arrested 1,200 of them. Many of them are still held 2 years later. Why? Because they were terrorists. They knew who the terrorists were. That's why we haven't had any terrorist attacks, because they arrested them all. But they can't tell the American people that, because could you imagine the response it would be if the American people knew that they knew the attack was coming and did nothing to stop it?
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess they think they're going to hide it, just like they hid what happened at Pearl Harbor and Roosevelt's plans to get us into war and get us on the side of the British and everything else that's...
Well, you know, that's another interesting parallel, because the FBI had combed through all the telephone books in California and had picked out all the names in the telephone books with Japanese surnames, and they were all set to go. As soon as Pearl Harbor was bombed, they moved in immediately and started arresting and detaining Japanese Americans and shipping them off to camps. And that was the result, once again, of something that had been carefully planned well in advance. They moved in immediately.
Okay, anything else, Jim?
That's all. Thanks a lot, you guys. I appreciate what you're doing.
Thanks for calling. My telephone number again, 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. That's 464-8295, and we've got somebody calling in again, and we'll try to get a couple of more calls in before the hour is over. But of course, the implications of what's happening now. September 11th changed America forever. As the president said, and it all came upon us in a single day, and night fell on a different world. world in which freedom itself is under attack. And that's absolutely true. Freedom is under attack, but not from the terrorists. It's under attack from the Patriot Act and the Model State Emergency Health Powers Act and Homeland Security Act and DARPA. They're collecting dossiers on every law-abiding citizen, not on the Muslims, not on the terrorists, on the law-abiding citizens. That's what it was really all about. Hi, Theodora. How are you doing?
Well, I'm doing a lot better than you, Dr. Stan, and I really want to echo someone else's statement earlier on that we all say a prayer for you, you know, that your voice comes back because you're such an important voice.
Well, thank you so much. It is getting better.
Oh, good. Okay, well, you're on the air. That counts. And I also wanted to, you know, salute this show because it is connecting the dots between Pearl Harbor and 9/11, and there's many other points in between and probably before where the similar pattern has played out. And I'm calling to make sure we don't forget the other dot to connect, which is how American money or certain dynasties' money goes to support the best enemies money can buy. And so that Hitler was supported by Prescott Bush, who's the grandfather of our current sitting president, George Bush. His father was actually convicted, I believe, in the Senate for aiding and abetting the enemy because he was part of the consortium, industrial consortium, that used their money to bring Hitler to power.
Grandfather's Harriman, right.
And Saddam was brought to power with, a certain sector of the American economy. Osama bin Laden benefited from deals with American presidents. And, you know, we really have to look at that piece of it, too, because that's, you know, we wouldn't be out there having so many enemies if the money wasn't creating them.
Well, yes,
right,
the Bush family and Osama bin Laden's family go way back, involved in the Mideast oil trade.
Well, it's very interesting, you know, in the last couple of days, there's been this article that immediately after the attack, why the Bush administration allowed the plane to round up the bin Laden family from all across America and then to whisk them out of the country. And, of course, this was before planes were flying, but they did allow this one passenger plane belonging to the family to just go around from spot to spot, find them, and then fly them out.
Mm-hmm.
That an article has just come out in this last 3 or 4 days. So we were certainly looking after the bin Laden's interests, but not after the interests of the people there in the World Trade Center.
Mm-hmm.
Well, again, thank you for this program because it really is the same old story. And how, you know, the question is, how do we get people to wake up and see it's the same old story and stop cooperating with the script?
Well, what we need to do, of course, Theodore, is get them listening not only to this program, but so many of the other great programs out there. We had Alex Jones as a guest this afternoon. He's doing a great job waking people up. And we just need more people on more stations telling the truth, because a lot of the American people will recognize it when they hear it. Maybe not those with a lot of education, but those just got a lot of good common sense. They can see the truth better sometimes than those with a PhD.
And that's the same old story, too, isn't it?
Right.
Yes. The more degrees you have, the more degrees of separation you have from, I guess, common sense. So. Anyway, thank you for more truth.
God bless. Good night, Theodore.
Good night.
Okay, fine. Well, again, our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California, 464-8295. Our guest is David Wade, and we're talking about his book, Infamy Revisited. David, as you've been going across America and doing radio programs on your book, what sort of response you've been getting?
You know, it's really amazing to me that there are so few people who have come forward to defend the Roosevelt administration. You occasionally run across somebody who will say, okay, so Roosevelt got us in the war, so Roosevelt knew that the Japanese were going to attack Pearl Harbor. So what? Because it was still serving a transcendent moral purpose, which was the defeat of fascist Japan and Nazi Germany. And this is the response that is the most common defense of Roosevelt. It's amazing how few people actually try to attempt to prove to me that Roosevelt didn't know or that he was innocent of trying to provoke a war with Japan. The public record of his diplomacy itself makes its own case, even if there was not a covert attempt to provoke Japan, just what he did publicly and what was documented in terms of agreements that he made, for instance, establishing joint talks among the chiefs of staff in Singapore, including the British and the Dutch, were gross violations of the law of neutrality under international law. And that's documented and beyond dispute.
Well,
the only defense they have, ultimately, is that, well, we had to get into the war because we and we alone could have defeated Japan and liberated Europe from the Nazis.
Okay, let's go to Diana in Aptos. Hi, Diana.
Hi, Dr. Stan. I'm a collector of odd and curious things, and I picked up a medal. It's a 33-degree Freemason medal, and it has a picture of Albert Pike on, who I didn't know anything about, and then I found a little information about him. And he wrote a letter in, it was written in to someone named Mazzini.
Mazzini, right, in Italy. He was the head of the Carabinieri over there.
Right, yes. And in 1871, where he said three future world wars would prepare the world for the new world order.
Well, we are approaching. We are in the Third World War. The average individual doesn't know.
Yes, and this is. I'll send you this two papers. Maybe you already have this, but
I do that. It's covered in a book. Stephen Emerson.
Yeah, Albert Pike was a very prominent Mason. He was also a Confederate general during the Civil War.
And also he started the Ku Klux Klan.
And he was one of the early. Founders of the Ku Klux Klan. He's the only Confederate general, by the way, who has a statue in his honor in Washington, D.C.
Is that Mazzini?
No, Albert Pike.
Oh, Albert Pike you're talking about now.
Yeah. But he is the father of modern-day Masonry, Diana.
Right, and I see that he says it would prepare the world for the pure doctrine of Lucifer.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
He was a Luciferian
all
the time. God bless him.
Yeah, and the destruction of Christianity.
Right.
Yep. I just wanted to throw that in.
Thanks
so
much.
I found it on Sunday. Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye. Okay, well, a lot of people are learning, and we're really encouraged that people are finding out what's going on, and they're telling other people. David, I want to thank you so much for being with us. It's been great having you.
Well, it's been a pleasure, and I hope to talk to you again soon, perhaps on another topic. I'll be working on another book here shortly.
Let me know as soon as you have it.
Okay.
Bye-bye. All right, well, this is Dr. Stan, and this is The Time, and I have to I'll remind you that Radio Liberty is listener-supported. We're dependent on those of you who believe in what we do to help us as we reach out. We're to about 59 different outlets every week now. It's exciting as we grow just a little at a time, and with your help and with God's help, I will continue reaching people as long as God gives me a voice, gives me back my voice under any circumstances. We ask you, of course, to pray for America. We ask you to pray for revival, because if this country does not turn back to God, God will never again bless this nation. And then, of course, we ask you to pray for our leaders and for our ministers, but please don't forget to pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. And so until tomorrow evening, when I'll be back. No, I won't be here tomorrow. That's Pastor Doug and Steve. I'll be with you Thursday. Until then, may the Lord be with you.